In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Every town has a dark side. This is Andrew Fitzgerald from the Everytown Podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and mysterious true crime stories, most of which you've never heard of. Stories like the bizarre disappearance of Tyler Davis in Columbus, Ohio, a 29-year-old father trying to find his way back to his hotel when he disappeared and was never heard from again, and Elizabeth Schoaf from Lugoff, South Carolina, who was abducted from her driveway by a madman and taken to his underground bunker in the woods. We give you all the details you're interested in hearing about without any fluff or fillers, because ain't nobody got time for that. We cover everything from psychopaths to poltergeists, so go check out the Everytown Podcast, because every town, no matter how nice it may seem, has a dark side.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius. A 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber. A mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
And welcome once again to another edition of Strange Planet. Thank you, as always, for sticking me in your ear. Regular listeners to this program and my other various radio programs over the years, over the last 20-plus years, are well aware that I have spent a lot of time talking about the attacks of 9/11. Of course, we're approaching the 22nd anniversary in just a few months. I've spent a lot of time discussing it from various angles. I've talked to dozens and dozens of witnesses and researchers and whistleblowers and examined it from just about every conceivable angle. But it's been a while since I've talked about it. We're going to delve back into 9/11 and some strange occurrences that occurred in the days following. Of course, officially, there were four planes, American Airlines Flight 11, United Airlines Flight 175, American Airlines Flight 77, and United Airlines Flight 93 that were turned into weapons, two of them striking the North and South towers of the World Trade Center. One of them crashed in Pennsylvania. Another hit the Pentagon. Recently, Fox News, I guess back in March, Fox News aired a special, a TMZ Investigates. They were talking about a fifth plane. This was a 6-month investigation that TMZ did into the potential that there was a fifth plane targeted by hijackers on 9/11. And this was a United Flight 23. It was a 767 aircraft that was scheduled to depart JFK at 9 a.m. It was bound for L.A. There were 6 passengers, apparently, that aroused the suspicion of flight attendants for various reasons. Apparently, one of the passengers was a man disguised as a woman. The plane was near the runway. It was ready to take off when JFK was abruptly closed after the World Trade Center was hit. And it taxied back to the gate. The plane was fully evacuated, locked 20 minutes later. People on the ground saw 2 uniformed police running in the passenger cabin. In came the authorities. They unlocked the door. They found the hatch leading from the belly to the cabin was open, something that obviously would alarm the FBI. The flight attendants were interviewed by the FBI, even taken to a lineup to see if they could identify the 4 passengers. There were box cutters that were found in the first class seat pockets on a 767 parked next to United 23. That plane was not scheduled to take off at the critical time. Anyway, my next guest says, forget about the fifth plane. That's barely scratching the surface. Carol Hellerman is a retired American Airlines international flight attendant, and she has a remarkable story to tell. Forget about the fifth plane. There were many others, and a great pleasure to welcome Carol to Strange Planet. Carol, how are you?
I'm good.
Let's begin with where you were on 9/11.
I was at JFK Airport. I was working flight 1 from JFK to LA. We were supposed to depart at 9 o'clock. I was the director at the front door, which is a flight attendant that directs people to either side of the airplane and where to sit. It was one of the days, what they said, the plane was light. There were very few people. We actually, when planes are light, they actually can leave earlier as long as everybody's on board. So we were getting ready to leave, and then it was about maybe 9:15. The gate agent came down and she said to me, come here. And she pulled me out on the jet bridge. And I looked up and she goes, look, a plane hit the World Trade Center. And I could see it burning from the jet bridge. So like everybody else, I thought, oh, some poor guy had a heart attack and, you know, he hit the Trade Center, you know. Nobody would ever think what really happened. So I go back on the plane. I run in the back to tell the other flight attendants. I come back up front and the captain makes an announcement. He says, ladies and gentlemen, due to an air disaster, our flight's been canceled. First thing I want you to do is say a prayer. And the second thing I want you to do is pick up your luggage and leave quietly. So I'm like, oh, they canceled the flight. So all of a sudden, 3 or 4 Middle Eastern men come up to the front and start arguing with the purser. The purser is the flight attendant who's in charge.
Right.
The lead flight attendant. Why is our flight canceled? And they're getting really upset. And, you know, and then, you know, they just left. So all the people deplaned. And we're on the plane wondering, you know, usually when they cancel flights, you think, okay, so you stick around, they might put us on another flight or, you know, have something else for us to do that day. So I was probably the last person in the country to know what was actually going on because I was on the plane.
Right.
The gate agent came down and she said, you all have to leave. They locked down Kennedy Airport. She said, she said, another plane hit the World Trade and one hit the Pentagon. And then we all put it together, obviously, that, you know, something really bad was going on. So in every, hub,
yes,
that American has, every airport that's their hub, we have an operations, which is, you know, an area where the flight attendants and you know, flight service can go and you can hang out and there's a TV and that kind of thing. So she said, everybody has to go to operations. They lock down Kennedy. Nobody can get out. So we get off the plane. And at this point, I didn't even know that it had been us. Flight attendants are running through the airport screaming, it's us, it's us. It was chaos. It was horrible. So we go up to operations and we basically just watch the planes, you know, I mean, the towers collapse.
Right. The South Tower collapsed at around almost 10 o'clock. So you watched the South Tower collapse. The North Tower collapses like half an hour later.
Right.
Wow.
So then they threw everybody out. They said, okay, Kennedy's being evacuated. So we all left. I got to the parking lot. I got in my car. Driving home was a nightmare because they let everybody out of work. So the roads were like packed. I get home. I'm very distraught, but I'm the type of person who doesn't fall apart until probably years later. I was very angry. I had wanted to be a flight attendant since I was 12 years old. I didn't become one until I was 40. I had only been flying a year and a half when this happened. And I was just really angry that they attacked my country, my city, my company. I was so mad because I had always wanted this. So I called up our schedulers the next day and I said, you put me on anything you have going out. So they said, we have a flight to San Francisco. Do you want it? I said, sure. What position? Now, on the plane, every flight attendant has a position of their, that's what their duties entail. So normally a person who's flying a year and a half would not be able to get this. So they said, what position do you want? In other words, nobody else wanted to go.
Right. If I could stop you there, Carol, just for a moment. You wanted to get like back in the saddle because immediately, like get up on that, you know, you fall off a horse, you get right back in it because you were angry and right. You decided not even this is going to stop me from doing right. What I do.
Right.
That was the motivation for getting back on that plane.
Right.
And
they weren't going to take it away from me.
Right. And they hadn't been grounded yet.
They had closed. Okay. This is the funny part. They had locked down New York City. Nobody could get in or out. So why I thought I was going anywhere on an airplane was beyond me. You know, it's like, really? You know, I didn't even think about that. I just went to the airport. There were three flights scheduled to go out, Miami, San Francisco, and LA. If you think about it now, all of those cities were ports where they could escape the Northeast and try and get out of the country. Those are all port of exits out of the country.
The terrorists, yes.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes. So I wasn't thinking anything. So I start walking to my gate and I look over to the left, and the gate over to my left had all kinds of confusion going on. There were Port Authority cops. There were like people all upset, but I just kept walking to my gate. My flight was San Francisco. So I get on the plane and I board the plane, and there were new hire flight attendants on the plane, which means they were on probation. They had just become flight attendants. They were crying, a lot of them. And I said to them, why are you here? And they said, well, they told us if we didn't come, we'd be fired. So they didn't even want to be there. So here I am with all these new hires trying to teach them what to do. And the captain comes on and the captain says, ladies and gentlemen, due to air traffic, we've been delayed. And I look at the flight attendant, I go, there's nothing up there. What is he talking about?
Right.
So all of a sudden, all the passengers are like on their phones. We heard that the flight next to us, that they found people with box cutters and knives, and they were all getting upset. So I basically took control and I said, look, I said, until the captain tells us what's going on, let's just calm down and we'll see what's happening. Okay. Well, another half an hour goes by, and the captain comes back on and he says, "Ladies and gentlemen, our flight's been canceled." So I'm like, okay. So all the passengers walk through, they all leave the plane, they get up and leave. The flight attendants, we stayed behind. There were other flight attendants who were deadheading, which means they were riding back home to San Francisco. They weren't working the flight. Right. So we all stayed behind to talk. Okay, so people are long gone. So finally, when we decide to leave and get off the plane, we get off and we start to walk down the terminal. Somebody, I don't know who it was, yells, "Turn around and run! Turn around and run!" And we all start running towards the end of the terminal. I'm next to the captain. I said to the captain, "What the hell is going on now?" He goes, "You know that LA flight over there?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "They just took people connected to the hijacking off of those planes. This, we were never going anywhere. This was a sting operation by the FBI.
Ah, well, that makes sense because, I mean, all flights, except for, I guess, emergency, like medical flights, were grounded the day before on 9/11 at like 9:45, before the towers fell. I mean, it was the FAA's director. It was his first day on the job. He grounded everything at 9:45. You don't know this, of course. You go to the airport, and they're making like it's business as usual, which is very interesting.
Well, this was not the same day. This was not 9/11. This was the next day.
Yeah, the next day, right.
Yeah.
Everything was, you didn't know this, and others didn't know this, but everything was, I guess, it was grounded, right?
Yeah, everything was locked down.
Yeah.
They locked down the bridges, the tunnels. Nobody could get out of New York, which I didn't even think about at that particular moment. But so they told the pilots about this, but they didn't tell the flight attendants that this was some kind of sting operation and we were never going anywhere. So when the flight attendants, well, finally, I saw a manager that I know, and there's a little room by the gates. It's a debrief room. And I saw the faces of the flight attendants that he took off that LA flight into the little room.
Yes.
It looked like somebody had killed them. I hear tell that only two of them came back to work and the rest of the flight attendants never, ever came back to work after that day because they were just horrified at what happened.
They realized that they were on a plane with terrorists who were supposed to be on other planes on 9/11 making other attacks. In other words, there were more than just more than five planes that were intended to be used as weapons. And the FBI knew this, so they basically laid a trap, and they were counting on terrorists showing up at JFK to get on planes that day. No intention of allowing them to take off. So,
right. Well, I'll tell you. After that day, I volunteered to fly again. So this is how I found out exactly what was the fate of my plane that day. I don't believe in coincidences.
Sorry, when you said your plane, you mean American Airlines Flight 1.
Flight 1 to LA the morning of 9/11.
Right.
So 4 days later when they finally allowed the planes to fly, or 5 days later, whatever it was, I brought back the first transcon from San Diego. I deadheaded out to San Diego, and I brought the plane back. So we're on the plane, in the back of the plane after service, and a gentleman, a captain, who was riding, he wasn't working the plane, came to the back to talk to us. So the captain comes to the back, and he says, starts talking about 9/11, and he says, "You know, I was on flight 1 to LA that morning." Now, flight attendants and pilots, you really don't see much of each other. Because, you know, I mean, you really, if you're in the back of the plane, you really don't even have much to do with them. So I didn't know what he had looked like, you know, that this had been my captain that morning. So he comes to the back of the plane and he says, "I was on flight 1. He said, "We were supposed to go to LA. He goes, "The FBI called me in to talk to me. And he told me that our plane was supposed to hit the Sears Tower in Chicago that morning.
hit the Sears Tower. There were hijackers on board.
They were going to take us into the Sears Tower. Yeah, that morning. He said, yeah, they told me they had a plane for every city in the U.S. This is what the captain said to me. Okay. Then I said, really? I said, I was on that flight. He said, really? He goes, well, did the FBI talk to you? And I said, no. And he goes, I told them, what are you talking to me for? You need to talk to the flight attendants who are out there in the aisle with these people. They could give you more information than I could. This is what the captain said to me. Okay. So that is how I found out that morning, the grand scheme of what I was supposed to. I also have talked to other flight attendants. There were some at Kennedy who were doing a London flight who say that they had very suspicious Middle Eastern guys on their flight also. And they were supposed to leave at like 9 o'clock also and never took off. There was a lot of people that I talked to who said that they had similar circumstances.
So American Airlines Flight 1, JFK to LAX, you're on that plane the morning of 9/11. It's there's not a lot of passengers, so you were going to take off early.
Mm-hmm.
It was intended by the terrorists on board, and I think you mentioned there were two Middle Eastern-looking gentlemen who came up the aisle and were very angry that the flight had been canceled. They were intending to fly that into the Sears Tower in Chicago. Was that part of a sting operation, or was it just lucky that it was grounded and didn't get to take off?
No, there was no sting operation on 9/11. That we were just lucky that we did not take off because you talk about the control tower man who was his first day there, the FAA gentleman who grounded the planes.
Yes.
Do you know why he grounded the planes? Maybe because there were two flight attendants that nobody ever talks about. There was Flight Attendant Ong and Flight Attendant Sweeney who were on Flight 11 who actually called operations and told them exactly what was going on. I know people who were in Boston operations who, while the manager was on the phone with them, while they were on the plane, telling them exactly what was going on that plane. They were on the plane with her, as a matter of fact, when they hit the tower.
Wow. That was American Airlines Flight 11. That was 11. Flying from Boston to LA, and that struck the North Tower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So and nobody ever talks about the reason why that most of the country was saved was because these two flight attendants got on their phones and called operations to tell them what was happening to them, which was horrific.
And the FBI never, ever spoke to you or any
nope.
other?
Nope. My captain told them to, according to him. He said, I told them to talk to the flight attendants, but nobody ever called me. As a matter of fact, after the sting operation, I called my union rep at JFK, who was a very horrible man who talked to me like I was a piece of garbage. Hmm. And said to me, well, why should anybody call you? Do you have information that could help catch them? He was very rude to me after everything I'd been through.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. Even the union rep was a horror.
Do you know what happened to those? Let's assume, maybe I shouldn't assume, but those two Middle Eastern looking men that were very agitated that the plane was didn't take off, the flight was canceled. Do you know if they were apprehended, questioned?
I don't know. They did lock down the airport. So I guess they knew that there might be other people in the airport, that had come off of other planes. But I don't know. It was so lax. Everything was so lax before 9/11. I mean, we would stand there with the cockpit door open, talking to the pilots for like 5 minutes. Nobody ever, it wasn't an issue.
How many sting operations do you have knowledge of that were taken?
Just Martin at Kennedy that morning. That's the only one that evening. That's the only one I know about.
Right. Although it's possible there may have been other ones at Logan in Boston.
There might have been. I did have a friend tell me that he was commuting, like flight attendants who fly out of New York. They live in Pennsylvania, so they'll commute to work on an airplane because it's free. So they'll live someplace else. He did tell me, one person did tell me that something similar happened to him in Pennsylvania, that he was locked down. It was some kind of like ruse that they were supposed to leave and then they never left. But he wasn't for sure that it was a sting operation. He just said that the same thing happened to him, where the planes weren't really flying. He didn't even think about it either, you know. I did, however, find out eventually what happened to the LA flight, that they took the guys off of the plane.
Right.
They were LA-based flight attendants who were supposed to be flying the plane that day. I used to do a lot of flights where I was an extra flight attendant. If a flight needs another flight attendant, if the passenger load goes up, they need to grab another flight attendant. So I happened to be flying with an LA crew instead of a JFK crew, instead of a New York crew. And I would constantly talk to other flight attendants about what happened to me with the sting operation. I wanted them to know. I wanted to talk about it. I was on a flight with LA flight attendants, and I started talking about it. And one of the male flight attendants says to me, "I was on that flight." I said, "You were?" I said, "What happened on that flight?" And he said to me, it was horrible. The commotion I saw with the Port Authority cops when I was walking by, he said, what had happened is supposed flight attendant got on the plane and said he was working the flight. They said, "Oh, well, how come you're working and you're not deadheading?" He didn't know what that meant. So they looked at his badge and they said it looked a little weird, didn't look right to them. So one of the flight attendants went, one of them kept him talking. The other one went out and told the gate agent. So they took him away in handcuffs. That's what was going on with the Port Authority cops when I got there. He said, then what happened was, you know, they did everything the way they were supposed to, you know, okay, flight attendants prepare for departure. They backed off the gate, he said, and the SWAT team came on board, flung open the front and back doors of the airplane, came down the aisle with rifles screaming, heads down, and took three or four guys connected with the hijacking off of the plane.
Wow.
And they, yeah, three or four terrorists who were still in the area. They took them off the plane at gunpoint.
And so they, the FBI or whomever, used crew and passengers as they put in harm's way these terrorists who were trying to get out of Dodge. They could have had box cutters. They could have had, they could have taken someone hostage, killed them. They could have been hit by friendly fire, the passengers and crew, and you weren't told anything.
The pilots knew. The flight attendants weren't to be told because, you know, they treated us like children. So, you know, we weren't to be told. But
that could have ended tragically. I mean, people could have died in that exercise.
But they did, you know, successfully take them off. As a matter of fact, when they finally told us that we could leave that the day of the sting operation, when we walked down the corridor and I looked at the gate, the LA flight, there was a SWAT team member with a rifle standing at the gate. So, yeah, it was very interesting, to say the least.
Carol, we're going to take a quick time out. We'll come back and discuss this this hidden episode in the days following 9/11. Carol Hellerman, retired American Airlines flight attendant, telling us this remarkable and harrowing story. Back with more in a moment.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive?
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator?
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. you'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you. Now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Lincoln County 911. There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries? Or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I'm a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
The truth will set you free. Free. But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Carol Hellerman is with us telling us a remarkable story. She was an American Airlines flight attendant. On 9/11, she was aboard American Airlines Flight 1, which was scheduled to fly out of JFK to LAX. She later learned that there were hijackers on board that plane, and they were intending to fly that plane into the Sears Tower in Chicago. So it wasn't just four planes that were turned into weapons. There were others, including American Airlines Flight 1. It just so happened that the flight was canceled because after the first plane hit the North Tower, the FAA closed all of the airspace. And then later, Carol, you show up at JFK wanting to get right back in the saddle. You weren't going to allow this episode to to take your love of flying away. So you showed up. You wanted to get on another flight. You later learned that flight had no intention of taking off. The FBI was using the crew and the passengers that boarded that plane. It was a sting operation to lure any remaining terrorists who were in the New York area. The idea was that they would want to get out of New York City, fly to the coast, a port of exit. So there were four suspected terrorists who were apprehended by a SWAT team on that plane?
I'm not sure the number. There were three or four. I don't remember exactly what he told me, but I know they knew exactly where they were seated and they were taken off at gunpoint, which is even more interesting.
Yes, because how did they get those names so quickly? What list were they working with?
Oh, I'm sure they had lists. The government must have had lists of the terrorists, no?
So quickly. Well, it's amazing how they didn't see it coming, and yet, they had no idea that passenger planes would be flown into buildings, and yet they had the names of these terrorists almost immediately. And again, you spoke with someone who was on another flight, and they told you that there were the terrorists had intended to fly planes and strike targets in virtually every major city in America.
That's what my captain told me, yes, that he had spoke with the FBI and that's what they told him.
Were these sting operations ever mentioned again, during the 9/11 hearings, during, the FBI put together that big and the DOJ, that big, you know.
I attempted to read that, but I didn't get through much of it. I didn't get through a lot of it, but I attempted to read that. I don't think this was ever mentioned, though. I think this is this is something they wanted to keep quiet. As a matter of fact, like I said, I talk. I was on the plane. There was a flight attendant on one of my flights, like maybe a year later, a year and a half later, and he happened to be the manager on duty at the airport that night, I would imagine, of the sting operation, because when I started telling my, I know that he had worked as a manager and then he went back to being a flight attendant, because they do that. They can go back and forth. And I was telling my story and he looked at me and he goes, "That never happened." And he gives me this face like, "Shut up." Okay. And I said, "Are you calling me a liar?" And he looked at me again and said, "That never happened." And I got really ticked off and walked. I was in the back of the plane. I walked up front to talk to the flight attendant up there. And he finally came up and I said, I was so mad. He came up and I said, "Really, you're calling me a liar?" He goes, "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that." Because I was just incensed. So, I don't know how they kept everybody quiet. The passengers on the LA flight, like people on my flight didn't really know what was going on because nothing happened on my flight.
Right.
But the people on the LA flight, I don't know how they kept them quiet. I have no idea how they were able to keep this under wraps. I do remember, however, calling my mother on the way home that night. And my mother said to me, "Oh, you never left." And I said, "No." And she said, "You know, it was really weird. I was watching the TV," she said, "and all of a sudden they cut in and they said, 'Just in from JFK. She goes, "and then they cut to commercial and then they never came back with it on the TV, on the news, on, you know,
right,
what was happening." So I found that a little weird, too, that my mother would tell me that.
There was another incident. It was a flight from Boston to L.A., a seventh plane, I guess, that was forced to land in Kansas City.
Yes.
Tell me
that. There's a site that only flight attendants have privilege to. And when they came out with the information about the fifth plane, a lot of flight attendants came out on that page saying, "Fifth plane, this happened, that happened." And one of the people said, "I was on a flight going to LA and they grounded us, you know, on 9/11 on that morning, they grounded us in Kansas City. And when they landed the plane, the FBI came in and took like three or four Middle Eastern guys off the plane." They said they were met and they were taken off. That's what they said.
I'm curious as to why they, the FBI, the DOJ, wouldn't want Americans to know the extent. I mean, because in the aftermath of 9/11, of course, we had the Patriot Act and we had all of these extra security measures put in place at airports. And we have, you know, since then we've discovered that the government spying on American citizens, but they're told, "Oh, it's to keep us safe from terrorism," and so forth. This would only add to their, I guess, their argument for the necessity of things like the Patriot Act and so forth, if Americans knew how much worse it could have been. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that would also probably would have crippled the airlines for a lot longer if people knew the extent, because, you know, people in L.A., it's like when there's an earthquake in L.A., people in New York go, "Oh, that was L.A." You know, or if so, like when this happened in New York, people were like, "Oh, that was just New York." You know, if they knew the extent, I think a lot of people wouldn't have flown. And I think that's what they were trying to accomplish, was, you know, making people so afraid to get on an airplane that would cripple our economy.
That's a great point. I didn't think of it from that aspect. Yeah, the airline industry would have been in.
Yeah, the airline. Right. And they basically, you know, I mean, cargo is a huge part of airplanes flying, too. So that would, like, basically stop a lot of, you know, mail and everything else. So
to this day, we don't know how many other potential hijackers were pulled off planes, how many were still in the New York area, how many escaped, how many maybe still among us. We don't know their names. We don't know if they were apprehended, what happened to them. Are they in Guantanamo? We don't know.
Well, see, that was my thought. Guantanamo Bay. Where did they get all those people, you know, in Guantanamo Bay? And if there weren't, if they didn't know about other planes, you know, having the same fate that day, why would they completely lock down New York City for a day or two or three? If they didn't hope to catch the remaining, they had to know there were others. No, it makes sense, yeah. Right?
Yes. Question is, how did they know beforehand there were others? How did they, you know, where did they get this list so quickly? If they had this list, could they have prevented, you know, the strikes on the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, the plane that ultimately crashed in Pennsylvania? How much did they know beforehand? I mean, this is obviously things I've been talking about for, well, going on 22 years now.
Yeah.
How are you now? How are you now? Even 22 years later?
I had post-traumatic stress. I was very angry for a very long time. As a matter of fact, just when my publicist, Jesse, had talked to me about, you know, maybe doing a book or talking about things, I didn't really want to do it because it would bring back up all the PTSD I suffered for a long time.
I can imagine.
It actually took 4 years for it to actually blow up. I was in London 4 years, was it 3 or 4 years later when they blew up the buses and tubes?
2006. You know,
the station? Yeah. I was there. I was 2 blocks away in London.
Wow.
And I was, you want me as your flight attendant because I flew back. I even handled difficult passenger. The plane landed. And after 9/11, our union put together a stress management team for any stressful events that happened to flight attendants, like, you know. So when we landed back at Kennedy from London, they met the airplane and they called in the back and they said, oh, they want to know if everybody's okay. And that was the first time I broke down crying. I cried for 4 days. My poor husband didn't know what to do with me. I talked to one of the flight attendants on the stress management team, and she told me, she gave me the name of a good psychologist. And, you know, basically I took a month off and I just went to therapy and worked it out. So,
Carol, I'm going to take another time out. We'll come back and chat for a few more minutes. Carol Hellerman telling a remarkable story about 9/11 you've never heard about until now. Back with more in a moment.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s?
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market. You know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. We're now crossing a zone of turbulence. Please return your seats and food trays to their upright position and make sure your carry-on luggage is safely stowed. You're about to leave everything you know behind. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Strange Planet.
We're back with Carol Hellerman, retired American Airlines international flight attendant. Was at JFK on the morning of 9/11. Was on flight one that was to fly to LAX. She later learned that plane had hijackers on it and was supposed to be flown into the Sears Tower in Chicago. The next day she went back to JFK thinking she wanted to fly again immediately. And after, witnessing the horror of 9/11, only to discover that the flight that was supposed to fly to LA, that was a sting operation. It was never going to leave the ground. It was being used to lure any remaining hijackers that were in terrorists in the New York area onto that plane so they could be apprehended. Hijackers thinking they could use that plane to fly to the coast and use that as an exit port so they could go back to wherever they came from, Saudi Arabia or wherever. You mentioned the PTSD. So you saw the you sat across from one of those hijackers that was going to fly that plane into the Sears Tower. You still see his face.
To tell you the truth, a week before 9/11, I was doing a flight from Fort Lauderdale back to New York, and they did trial runs for probably years. They were our best customers, the terrorists. They were platinums. They watched us. They knew exactly what we were doing. They had been watching us for years to see our habits, when the cockpit door was open, everything. Okay. A week before, I actually was sitting across from them, but I had no idea. I was sitting on my jump seat. They were sitting across from me and they were staring at me like they wanted to kill me. The plane got up, and people usually stare at you, so you stare back at them and they look away. They didn't look away. We got up and we started to do service, and I leaned in and I said, "Can I get you something to drink?" And they just stared at me and they didn't answer me. Nothing. So I thought they was Hispanic. I didn't know. I didn't know what their, ethnicity was. So I said, "Bebidas," which means drinks in Spanish. And they looked at me and they said, "I'm not Spanish." And I said, "Well, do you want something to drink?" And they just said, "No." And that's one of the behaviors that they displayed. And that's one of the things that they did, was they knew what seats to sit in, because what they did is they positioned themselves across from the flight attendants. So when the plane took off, they stood up and they slit the flight attendants' throats. A week before I did, but I was directing that morning. I just saw them come up and argue with my purse or so. Thank God they weren't sitting directly across from me. Not that I knew of, actually, because I never did really take my seat that morning, because I was directing at the front of the plane. So, but anyway.
What was the decision? What made the decision for you that you were going to come forward and speak about this for the first time?
I really didn't want to. my husband and Jesse, who actually I went to high school with Jesse, and it was just kind of a coincidence that I ran into him, and, we started talking and I was telling him about my 9/11 experiences, and he told me, "You should write a book." And I said, "Yeah, you know how many people have told me I should write a book?" But he says, no, you should write a book and I want to help you. And, you know, and I thought about it for a while and it started to get me back. I had basically lost a lot of my anger and my, you know, the PS, you know, my post-traumatic stress. And I really didn't know if I wanted to do it. And he said, you should do it. It'll be cathartic. You need to talk about this. You need to get it out. And my husband agreed with him. So I agreed to do it. So, you know, for years, you really, as a flight attendant, you really cannot talk about this. They make you sign you can't talk to the press. They make you sign a
NDA, a non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah, you are not allowed. God forbid anything happens, you are not allowed to talk to the press about it. So, you know.
You mentioned so the FBI.
Now that I'm fired, I don't think that really applies to me.
Right.
So I don't know what they could do about it anyway. You know, they can't fire me.
So are you going to write that book, Carol?
I would love to write that book, yes. But, you know, we'll see.
And you mentioned the FBI never spoke to you, but did other American Airlines officials speak to you? And I don't know, were there any threats or coercion to, you know, I mean, I know you had an NDA, but...
Right. No, it's just known. Nobody threatened me, but it's just known you don't do it or you're fired. I mean, you cannot. That's one of the rules as a flight attendant. You better not open your mouth. That's known. Nobody has to threaten you with that. Basically, I've seen people gone, you know, so, yeah.
Now that this story is getting out there, and I don't know whether you'll be allowed to, for example, tell your story on a major news outlet.
Probably not, because I'll need cooperation. And there's not a lot of people who are willing to talk about this. Because one, like I said, it'll bring this all back up again, which is very painful. And two, you know, if they're still working for the airline, they don't want to be fired. So, you know.
So what do you think is important to for people to know or understand now? Here we are approaching the 22nd anniversary of 9/11. It could have been far, far, far worse. It could have been planes flying into buildings on every major city in America.
Right.
We weren't allowed to know about that. What does that say about America, I guess?
Lately, there's a lot of things you can say about America. It's like a parent, I guess, like they're trying to prevent child, like we're children, like we can't handle the truth. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
There's a lot of things that are out there that I'm sure we don't know about because they think that the American public can't handle the truth.
Do you think there may be even a more sinister motive? Again, we get back to that list. How did they pull that list out of thin air and know who the hijackers were, their names, so quickly after the event?
Well, if you want to get, you know, I mean, let's face it, they did want to go to war. You know, there are a lot of people who wanted money. You know, they get those government contracts and, you know, war is good, right? For the economy.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah, well, there you go. So there's a lot of things you can speculate about as to why they did what they did. You know.
Well, Carol, I hope you find some catharsis. I hope you do write that book. I think Americans and, well, the world really needs to know this story. And I thank you for having the courage to bring it forward and spending some time with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Carol Hellerman.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.